gentlemen, Anthony Fantano here, internet's busiest music nerd, and it is another episode of the Needle Drop Podcast, a weekly roundup of our best reviews and thought pieces throughout the week on the Fantano channel, though we don't have any in this particular episode. This edition of the Needle Drop is reviews, 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 reviews. We're hitting you with one after another with my takes on the latest records from Oconcolo, a Santeria Latin group that makes religious music with some pretty beautiful arranged instrumentation, which you should find pretty enchanting. Also, my thoughts on the new Eve Tumor album. Also talking about the latest Suicide Boys album, the New Orleans rap duo. We're going to be taking on the latest album from very mediocre and stomach-churning rapper Russ. His latest record is Zoo. And going to top it all off with a review of the latest album from Thou, sludge metal band Thou. I'm also going to be doing some track reviews of the latest songs from Lana Del Rey and Eminem's diss track to Machine Gun Kelly. That's what we're going to give you in this episode of the Needle Drop Podcast. So hang back, sit tight. Here we go. Ba-bam.
Whoa. And it's time for a review of the new Oconcolo album, Cantos. This is the debut full-length album from Oconcolo, a New York-based group with Afro-Cuban and Yoruban roots. And even though the group itself may be relatively new, it does feature veteran musicians who have been playing Latin music for quite a while and are also adherents to the Santeria religion. I don't usually dive that deeply into the religious background of the musicians that I cover on this channel. However, this was kind of a special case, as the songs on this album are very much an exercise in the Santerian faith, not just because of the lyrics on the album and the call and response chants used throughout this record too, but also because of the prominence of bata drums on this record as well, a hand drum which has a long history of use in religious practices and goes beyond just a musical tool. As in an interview, bandleader Abraham Rodriguez describes his entrance into the Santeria religion with a ceremony where it needed to be seen whether or not the spirit of the drum accepted him as his son. So the vocal and drumming style central to the religious practices that I've been talking about are very much central to the music on this record pretty much throughout, with some occasional moments where the band might pick up the pace, pick up the groove, and add in some more accessible Latin music passages. Still, though, even in its catchiest moments, the religious angle of this record cannot be ignored. It is very prevalent. Even the title of this album, Cantos, can be interpreted to mean chants in a religious context. But the recordings on this album are arranged in such a way where they can be enjoyed pretty easily outside of the purview of religion, as producer and musician Jacob Plass, who collaborated with the band on this record, brings in tons of guitar, bass, strings, brass, reeds to really color the band's vocals and drums. And the instrumental additions to the chants and rhythms on this record are actually pretty tasteful and powerful, and only help the band's already entrancing sound become even more transcendental. The drumming on this thing, for the most part, is fantastic. You're talking about a group of people playing hand drums. It is the most organic a groove can get. It's so natural, it flows so beautifully. This album has groove. And the vocals on this thing are equally impressive, especially when they're being delivered by the group's two female singers, Emma McKen and Jadelle McPherson. The lead vocal that opens up the track Oba is absolutely stunning. Maybe one of the most stunning moments on the entire record. It's soul-shocking. It sounds like I'm listening to a ghost sing a beautiful song of loneliness from another dimension. Some of the background vocals feel a bit off, but I think their slightly sour demeanor only adds to the character of the track and the forlorn attitude of some of the vocal passages. Meanwhile, Jacob's arrangements on the track are ever shifting. From strings to reeds to guitar and bass, it never really settles into one idea for too long. He's always throwing things and swapping stuff out given whatever the emotional tone of the vocals and the drums are. As the instruments he places on the very very moody intro contrasts pretty boldly from the groovier moments on the back end of the track, which is one of many amazing instrumental transitions throughout the album. The song Ocean, for example, goes from beautifully tragic to full-on Latin dance section with sparkly guitars and funky horns in its final moments. And the track Canto Essoyen sounds strangely sassy. There's something kind of joyous and smiley and playful about the call and response vocals on this specific track, not to mention the fat swinging horn lines that play throughout a good deal of the cut sound like something out of an old R&B song. And no, I don't mean like an old school 80s or 90s contemporary R&B song, I mean like from the 50s, like rhythm and blues. But suddenly the track is thrown into these darker and chillier vocal lines that get a touch of wintry atmosphere from the backing instrumentation. The mood transitions on this record are so fantastic, it's like Jacob and the group really pull the rug out from under you, but in a pretty thrilling way much of the time, especially with the creative layers of vocals and horns that the track eventually evolves into. I wish more songs on this album unfolded this intricately, or subtly, like in the case of the gentle and intoxicating Obatala. And the track Canto Por Un Chun is one of the most chillingly beautiful spots on the entire record too. The song sounds like a grand pilgrimage across the astral plane, with the vocals and the drums kind of setting the pace. The ethereal and swelling tones that Jacob places into the background add to the grandness of the musical presentation, and the track feels larger and larger as it progresses forward, despite the very humble bass line of drums and vocals. Now, there are some downsides to the songs on this album, unfortunately. I do think that sometimes the arrangements, the vocals, and the drums almost feel like they are coming from different places, kind of like the extra bits of strings or synths or ethereal effects just feel a little tacked on, just kind of coloring on top of what the vocals and drums are doing, as opposed to being integrated with them. For example, the soaring string sections on Abraham's voice on the track Wolenche Por Chango feel less like a religious experience and more like musical theater. And given that what we're being presented with here are religious chants and not pop tunes, some of the structures aren't all that traditional or predictable. So some of the transitions and finishes of these tracks come off a bit awkward or super abrupt. For example, the opening track, Yamaya, has one of the most dramatic intros on the entire album, sets the tone of the record beautifully. The drum and vocal progressions on this track are fire. Eventually, the track reaches a point where it is met with these shimmery, either string or synth sounds that are really beautiful, otherworldly. The pace gets faster and faster. Some very dramatic woodwinds are introduced to enhance the chord changes. But then all of a sudden, the track just stops. It ends super suddenly, mid-progression. It's just over like that. It's like the track just literally evaporates, or the rapture took it away, as it was just in the midst of building up to what I do not know. Meanwhile, the track Canto Por Obatala seems like a pretty straightforward chant with some little woodwind and horn sections to kind of enhance the spots in between the vocals. I won't deny that the singing is nice and the instrumental melodies are pretty mystical, but the song doesn't really build up toward anything. It's a lot of tension, but not a whole lot of ascension. The closing track, in my opinion, trails off very much at its finish, and a lot of the progressions up until that point feel a little random and don't really build up a whole lot of momentum. Even though it does sound pretty, despite the fact that some of the opening vocals are a little rough, it's kind of like hitting the reset button numerous times on the track as it transitions from one idea to the next. It's like everything that it's been building up to that point just crumbles and it starts anew. And I do not mean that in a way that improves or enhances the song all that much. Still though, I enjoyed this record quite a bit. It's 9 tracks, it's 34 minutes, it's pretty tight, it's sweet on the ears, it's beautiful. As I said, there is a transcendental quality to it, a haunting quality to the religious chants, the drumming, and the gorgeous arrangements. I see this album as a beautiful little spiritual oasis that I just did not see coming, and I'm really happy entered into my life. I wish some of the tracks on this thing were a bit longer or made grander musical statements, but as short as some of these songs and this album are, this thing is packed with powerful performances, flavorful instrumentation, lots of intense emotions, some thrilling twists and progressions too. I'm feeling a strong 6 to a light 7 on this thing. Transition
into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the new Eve Tumor album, Safe in the Hands of Love. This is a musical project spearheaded by producer and songwriter Sean L. Bowie, who first started grabbing my attention earlier this year when Warp Records picked him up and started dropping singles for tracks like Noid and Licking an Orchid and Lifetime, all three of which forecast an album of dramatic, lush art pop with nice organic production. Seemed like there was quite a bit of inspiration being taken from acts like Blur or Dean Blunt and 90s club and hip-hop music. However, now that I have the whole album in front of me, I was pretty surprised to hear that the stylistic influences on this thing run much deeper than that. I was also pretty surprised to learn about Sean's very deep roots in the experimental scene running into the earlier part of this decade, diving into everything from post-industrial music to hypnagogic pop, ambient music, sound collage, and deconstructed club. He's also worked with the likes of James Ferraro and Lee Bannon. Everything I read about him said to me he was this versatile underground creative who was finally getting the attention he deserved through this Warp Records nod. So going into this album, I was pretty curious to hear what exactly Bowie's specialty or sound is under the Tumor name, as his previous solo efforts weren't really all that stylistically consistent, certainly experimental in that they cast a very wide stylistic net, going from track to track to track. A lot of bases get covered, and while Safe in the Hands of Love is similarly all over the place, it's not nearly as risky as previous efforts, though I think that's partially the secret sauce with this new album, that Bowie would find a successful middle ground where his ideas could have wide appeal amongst alternative music fans, but also sound refreshingly weird. And that's not to say that there aren't odd musical outliers in the track list on this album. There are, but sometimes that's where this record goes awry. The song Honesty is the album's lone track with an overt techno influence. Super milky synth bassline on this cut, drums that sound like they were produced on a factory floor with a super sharp reverb. Bowie inserts these incredibly angsty and moany lead vocals into the instrumental, without which I would have just not really thought much of it. That's not to say the singing improves the song any, though. I actually find the vocal performance on this track to be kind of tedious, not nearly as good as a lot of the vocals on the rest of the record. The song Economy of Freedom feels like a scattered piece of post-industrial dance music, with fractured melodies and gargantuan, crushing percussive hits and lots of buzzing, swelling synths. Very much in the same vein as past material you might have heard from Arca or 10 Tricks Point Never, and I bring them up as a reference point because Bowie himself in his previous efforts is no stranger to these post-industrial and deconstructed club sounds, though I don't really find his sound play on this track to be all that novel or cutting edge. The best moments on the song come together when the drums, the synthesizers, the vocals come together into a cogent song in the last leg. The intro to the album is okay, but fails miserably at setting the tone of the record, because the dramatic drums and woozy horn samples don't really fit aesthetically with the rest of the record and sound more fitting for an abstract jazz rap album. Meanwhile, All the Love We Have Now is a pretty sweet hypnagogic detour. Aesthetically, it's pretty cool, but the song at the core of it is really just too indirect, makes the whole thing just sound like an overextended interlude. Really, the best experimental spot on the entire record had to be the track Hope in Suffering, which was legitimately unsettling. This totally warped and out-of-nowhere spoken word piece delivered in a British accent. The instrumental is packed with dreary strings and apocalyptic drones, gunshot sound effects too. Meanwhile, the lyrics are pretty grim and violent and dystopian. It really is a frightening moment on the album that gets more and more intense as it moves along. The closing track is pretty cacophonous, finishes the album off with a bang. I like what Bowie is doing here aesthetically. The noisy instrumentation is intense, but I just fail to see what this song does to kind of tie up a bow for this very lopsided and inconsistent album. Really, the best chunk of songs on this entire record comes right in the center, like from tracks 4 to 8, some of which are the catchiest songs on the entire record too. The song Noid is like this catchy and confident pop oasis in the middle of the record. From the crispy beat to the warm bass line to the shimmering strings, the instrumental on this track is fire. There are some interesting chord changes throughout the track too. I like the sort of snobby snobby lead vocals that once again feel like they're inspired by Britpop and just rock from the UK. The tune is impeccably catchy. I like the lyrics kind of dealing in themes of violence and peace. I also love the subtle instrumental chaos that grows and grows as the song progresses. Then there's the heart-wrenching
Licking
in Orchid, which features some chilling guest vocals that add to the song's sad beauty. Some springy acoustic guitar licks, which are pretty gorgeous. The bass and drums from the previous track also carry over onto this song and play just as effectively under this much sadder piece of music. The song Lifetime and Recognizing the Enemy are also very solid tunes with a similar instrumental palette, and they are equally as appealing too. Just kind of a shame that Bowie wasn't able to embrace and explore these sounds more throughout the rest of this album, because they're easily the most memorable and enjoyable spots on this entire record. So again, would have been nice to hear more of that, or have Bowie more effectively connect these much more experimental spots to these songs so that it adds up to a more cohesive listen as an album. Because while there are quite a few good tracks on this record, they do very little to reinforce each other. Overall, I think this is a pretty decent, likable record. It does have quite a few high points, though it also doesn't really seem to know what it wants to be or do. It's almost like a randomized series of musical sketches. And while there are albums out there that use that to their advantage, I don't think Safe in the Hands of Love is really as unpredictable as it needed to be, because as I stated earlier, Bowie's previous solo efforts were certainly more all over the place and unpredictable than this new album over here. Though I do think some of the more direct and art pop oriented cuts on this thing do open a door, a potential way forward for Eve Tumor. Because honestly, songs like Lifetime and Noid, I would not mind hearing more of that. I'm feeling a strong 6 to a light 7 on this thing.
Transition into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the brand new Suicide Boys album, I Want to Die in New Orleans. This is the long-awaited debut commercial album release from the Louisiana hip-hop duo Suicide Boys. Scrim and Ruby joined up under this name in 2013, and it has been an endless string of releases from both of them since. Numerous mixtapes and an almost countless string of EPs, most of which dropped in 2017 alone, if I'm not mistaken. For whatever reason, the boys have just preferred to drop a bulk of their music in these 3 to 6 song bits, which is fine, but I didn't really have a lot to say about a majority of these EPs, as a bulk of what they released was pretty much just the duo continuously spinning their wheels in this revivalism of old school horrorcore and Memphis hip hop, giving nods to everything from old school 3-6 Mafia to underground obscurities like Blackout's Dream World tape, delivering to audiences a lot of dark and murderous and blasphemous lyricism, parsed out into these rippity-dippity, rippity-dippity, rippity-dippity triplet flows. The Suicide Boys formula is pretty obvious at this point, whether it be because you've heard some of the duo's previous EPs or you're familiar with the classic hip-hop albums that the duo pretty much use as inspirational source material. However, I Want to Die in New Orleans is maybe the first project from both of them that sort of stopped me in my tracks, where their usual predictability didn't get to me quite as much, and they actually managed to grab my attention for more than a track or two. Mostly because it felt like the vibe of this new project over here was a bit more distinct and freakish and in your face, and not merely a near anonymous group embracing some old school Memphis rap pastiche. But even though I think this album is pretty decent, I think a majority of its appeal is just sort of skin deep for me. This thing has a supremely dark and grimy vibe, very rough, textured, eerie, and aggressive production. The flows on this thing generally are pretty tight. It seems almost as if there is a slightly larger focus on hooks with this project too, some of which really pop, like on the track Nicotine Patches, One Day I'll Forget the Name, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or one more that really stood out to me, Save Me From This Hell, Let Me Rest in Peace. Some of the melodic flows on the track Phantom Menace are really sharp. The rumbling bass and dirty drums on that track add quite a bit to its appeal too. But there are still a lot of very glaring shortcomings with what Suicide Boys bring to the table here. Lyrically, it's pretty surface level with a lot of references to drugs and violence, with a slightly edgier presentation than what you would catch on any other rap record that approaches these very same topics. And the appeal of the lyricism doesn't really come down to a sense of humor or skilled wordplay, but instead being really morbid and grim. And sometimes it does work, like on the track Wartime All the Time, where it seems like the duo are writing from the perspective of a mass shooter who is also an ex-soldier who is addicted to drugs and suffering from PTSD. Not really an angle you hear all that often, and a lot of the duo's other lyrics also feed into these very authentic and potent and consistent themes of depression and isolation, also kind of embracing their outsider status in the rap game. But simultaneously, there are spots on this album where the lyrics can come off a bit too edgy or try hard or basic, maybe even juvenile, especially on the track Mr. Nice Guy, where some of the darker and more violent themes throughout the group's lyrics also get mixed with some romantic bits, and it's a really awkward combination. And on top of it, for music that's obviously trying to build on the spirit of horrorcore, the album here, it's not very cerebral. It's not incredibly frightening. I do give it kudos, though, for just oozing pessimism and negativity. There truly is nothing nice or friendly about this record. So even when this album is lacking, it at least has that going for it. I guess another major downside to this project is that a lot of the songs on here are super short, lacking in structure. I don't know what it is about a lot of these new Memphis rap revivalists where they just have this need to slap together an intro, a verse, a chorus, and then end it, or an intro, two verses, and then just end it. If you've got good flows and some great dark production, it can bring a strong vibe, but in terms of songwriting and memorability, it doesn't leave that much of an impression, especially when you're killing almost 20 seconds in your own song by just rolling through a very faint vocal sample from another track in between a couple of verses. Something the boys do far too often on this album, to the point where it just feels like they're using it to fill out tracks. And it's certainly not a replacement for a hook or actual songwriting. But I guess the upside of all of these songs feeling very vibey is that it comes together as an album into a pretty seamless listen. But then the downside of that is a lot of these songs tend to blend together. I mean, I can kind of see why the duo have an aversion to longer songs with more structure, because some of the tracks on here that do exactly that are a few of the most underwhelming on the entire record, like the track Carrollton and the 7-minute closing song, I No Longer Fear the Razor Guarding My Heel, which has its bright spots, but it mostly just feels like a bunch of random songs that could have been placed earlier in the track list, mashed up into a long song. As the first 2.5 minutes of the track feel like a song, then it transitions into another 2.5-minute song. Then there's another transition from there into an outro. It just feels very disconnected, as there doesn't really seem to be a guiding theme that brings these different tracks lumped together into one track together. Yeah, overall, I think this album is pretty likable, but it's not very standout, and I think the Suicide Boys continue to punch under their weight on this thing, which is a shame because there aren't a whole lot of groups out there doing this sound, reviving this sound, and doing it well. And even though I enjoyed quite a few tracks off of this project, I just don't see how Suicide Boys have really evolved that much artistically since they first started turning heads on SoundCloud. And they've certainly had plenty of time to advance, certainly as much time as other artists who started in a similar area in a similar time and were also influenced by some of the same artists they were, Denzel Curry. Hopefully now that the duo are putting themselves out there and taking this risk by embodying their sound into an album, they are ready to kind of turn a page into a new chapter and kind of grow and mature what they've been doing here a little bit and bring audiences an album that might have a more refreshing sound, has a bit more conceptual weight, or a bit more forethought. I'm feeling a decent 2 strong 6. On this thing, transition
into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the new Russ album, Zoo. New Jersey rapper, songwriter, producer Russ, he is back with a new album since dropping his breakthrough record last year, There's Really a Wolf. Musically speaking, 2017 was a pretty huge year for Russ, but while his album was doing numbers and going platinum, it seemed like he was gaining attention for all the wrong reasons. In numerous public statements, he just took a really confrontational tone with the current state of hip-hop, which put a lot of eyes on the guy, but didn't really do all that much for his public image. And it's not that I think this new wave of hip-hop and trap music are above critique. I make it my business to do that on a weekly basis, and I'm still here. But what I think Russ isn't really appreciating is who's the messenger here and what is the intent of that message? Because Russ is not coming at the genre with the experience and the classic discography of a vet. Even though he has quite a few projects under his belt, he's really at the point in his career where he's just kind of getting started, and why should anybody listen to you? Just because you rap and produce and you have one platinum album, it doesn't make you God's gift to the genre. And it also seems like a lot of his critiques on this new wave come from a really awful place. Sometimes he's deriding the drug culture in the genre at the moment. Sometimes he's attacking a perceived lack of talent or authenticity, both of which seem driven by this very obvious bitterness over not being welcomed with open arms into the current state of hip-hop. Which is really odd because, technically speaking, it's not like Russ is all that much better. Topically, he's only a shade less materialistic and even chauvinistic than a lot of these other rappers that he's making fun of. The song From a Distance is all about him rapping and singing about this girl next door who he's like continuously cheating on the road, and basically expecting her to just sit there and wait for his short ass because he needs time to adjust to being famous. And believe me, you'll never go too long on this album without hearing Russ brag about how much money he's made, his mansion, how he's buying his family houses, he's taking care of everybody, he makes this, he makes that, he has this, he has that. You cannot continuously throw shots at this new generation of rappers while simultaneously being mediocre at best yourself. And to go back to Russ's previous attacks on drug culture, it doesn't really seem to come from a place of sympathy for addicts or addiction. It all just feels like an extension of his superiority complex, which he just can't seem to get a hold of. Now, listen, I wouldn't normally go this deep into the personality and the drama surrounding a particular artist before I get into talking about the music that's actually on their album. But the problem is that Russ also uses his music as a platform to blow off steam about the hate he receives for being a hater. The closing track, Flute Song, Outlaw, Kill Them All, there are numerous songs on this record where Russ is just going off about other young rappers being dumb and ignorant and drugged out and materialistic. The industry, journalists, all the lies told about him, the hate, the pressure, his lone wolf status. He even drops a bar on this record about other rappers playing the same festivals he does, but when they see him in person, oh, you guys talk shit on the internet, but you don't do nothing. Which is a line I could have passed or taken in stride had my review not come after this recent story of him sending people he knows to beat up Smoke Perp just because you guys have like some online rap beef. It's pretty weak to hear tough talk from somebody who needs to send other people to hurt their enemies for them because they can't do it themselves. Honestly, the attitude that permeates a lot of this record isn't too unlike that of Eminem's recent album, Kamikaze, an artist who's found themselves in the midst of an incredible amount of success, but they're still angry at the whole world and they are gonna take their anger out on everyone. Except Russ doesn't have any of the hits that Eminem does, nowhere near the same skill level or talent. He doesn't even really have a unique voice or rap style or production style. Even though it does lead to some of the more aggressive and compelling moments on the album, Russ really does waste too much breath attacking these Flavor of the Month rappers who are going to disappear in the next 5 years, whether he comments on them or not. Which is why it is hilarious projection to hear Russ ranting on this album about all these journalists and rappers are just hating on me for the clout. Meanwhile, if this new wave of hip-hop didn't even exist, what would you be so angry about? Where would you be? What would you be doing? I can tell you one thing, if this album didn't come out, I would review another album. I'd still have work to do. But if Russ didn't have anyone to hate, what would he be doing? Well, he would most likely be dropping gentrified, lovesick pop rap tunes like the track Missin' You Crazy, or boring, bland, pillowy luxury rap on the track Last Forever with Rick Ross and Snoop Dogg. At his worst on this album, Russ just jams these buttery bops that sound like if Drake didn't have any personality or the ability to write a mega hit. When he's tolerable, it kind of sounds like he's throwing it back stylistically to the late 90s, the flows are above average. The beats are very polite, but they boom and bap a little bit. Occasionally, there's a clever bar. He sounds a little angry. Seems like he's kind of enjoying himself, getting back at his haters. Certainly, tracks like Outlaw and Kill Them All are pretty cool if I ignore who the music is coming from. And to add to that, I was legitimately captivated by the track Parkstone Drive, where Russ does spit some compelling bars about how money, fame, and a bad marriage between his parents were kind of tearing his family apart. It's easily the most respectable expression of emotion on the entire record. However, a handful of likable or tolerable songs do not prevent this Titanic from sinking, because it is really weighed down in a lot of awful and boring songs, not to mention Russ's crummy mindset. Because honestly, there are a lot of rappers out there that get clowned for being corny. Guys like Logic and J. Cole, G-Eazy, Hobson, Drake, Joyner Lucas too. A lot of these guys more talented than Russ, being made fun of more than Russ. However, they've somehow managed to take it in stride and handle it with more grace. This is a very tiresome and self-centered album, with very little in the way of an appeal outside of people who are somehow invested in Russ's struggle, or have somehow been tricked into thinking that Russ firing back at his haters qualifies as smart social commentary. Meanwhile, the poppier tunes on this record just sound like hip-hop music for people who write that they listen to everything but rap and country in their dating profile. I'm feeling a light 2, decent 3 on this thing. Transition
into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the new Thou album, Magus. This is the latest full-length album from Baton Rouge sludge and doom metal band Thou. I first covered the band's music back in 2010 when they released their breakout album Summit, a record that showed Thou to be one of the most exciting up-and-comers that sludge and doom had to offer. And even though Summit didn't make my favorite albums of the year list, it did offer 4 massive tracks with abrasive vocals and guitars, a massive and apocalyptic sound moving at a glacial pace, and outside of getting some heavier production and a larger presentation, Thou's sound has not changed all that much since then. Though their last full-length album, Heathen, pushed their sound to the limits of intrigue with a 75-minute runtime. An album that long is not necessarily a bad thing in theory, but I didn't really feel like Thou's sound and style was really so versatile that it was done any justice by being strung out to that length. Plus, their latest full-length LP over here is pretty much the same amount of time, stretched over nearly the same amount of tracks, and unfortunately, the band hasn't really made their sound that much more interesting with an hour and 15 minutes of time to play with. I mean, there are some admirable things the band are doing this time around. Easily, Magus features the best production on any Thou album so far. Their very noisy and brittle take on sludge most definitely plays into a long line of artists from the Louisiana area who have done that very same thing, like I Hate God. The abrasive guitars and vocals on this thing, combined with the grand atmosphere the band presents, almost strikes a slight black metal tone at points on this record. I'm not saying it's an overt influence or an intentional reference, but merely an interesting similarity. The band are also doing a slightly better job of coloring these very slow, heavy riffs all over the album with some incredibly triumphant and tragic guitar melodies, some of the best of which turn up on the Changeling Prince. Occasionally, the performances on this thing can be pretty crushing too, like the blaring and aggressively played guitar chords sync up really well with the bone crushing drums on the Kingdom of Meaning. But despite all of these good things that Magus has to offer, I'm still at a point where I feel like Thou are stretching a somewhat one-dimensional sound very thin with these massive runtimes. I mean, the obvious need for a breather is very much addressed by the band with these kind of shorter interlude-type tracks that pop in every once in a while that feature some softer, spacier tones, a lot of atmosphere, just to bring some kind of counterpoint to the endless and vast sludgescapes the band brings on most of the tracks here. And even though it is a nice touch, it doesn't change that I just feel this need for a bit more variation from tracks like Inward and Sovereign Self, both of which could have gotten a bulk of their ideas out in a much shorter runtime. Occasionally, the band will work in a soaring or shimmering guitar lead into their usual repertoire. Or even on Kingdom of Meaning I mentioned earlier, there's a clean vocal that pops in miraculously in the second leg, which was a really nice touch and did add to the likability of the track quite a bit. It's also worth noting the band does bring in some shots of feedback and roaring walls of guitar distortion to break up some of the monotony on the closing track, Supremacy, the last leg of which is a huge dissonant drone that certainly ends the album off with a bang. But still on Magus, Thou's sound is not really all that dynamic, nor are their compositions so engaging that they're really worth eating up every second of. Which is not necessarily a bad thing for a band in the sludge or doom metal category, because there are plenty of groups in that genre that you can really just stew in their sound. I can sit and soak in a Dope Smoker. I can sit and soak in some Electric Wizard or a Satan-worshipping Doom. But I guess I just don't find Thou's sound so aesthetically appealing that I can just sit with it, without an attention-grabbing progression or a super-aggressive performance. Because, for the most part, Thou's sound is really too abrasive and harsh to feel cerebral or numbing, and yet, the album wasn't consistently explosive and hard-hitting enough to feel visceral throughout for me either. This thing just sits in a weird middle ground that doesn't really scratch either itch for me significantly enough. Despite my complaints on this thing, I do think this is a likable album, and it is certainly fine while it's on, but there's not a whole lot about this thing that makes me want to come back to it outside of a couple tracks. The size of this record is pretty impressive. The production throughout is pretty nice. The performances are solid too. I'm feeling a light to decent six on this thing.
Hey buddy, did you hear the news? It's track reviews.
Hi everyone, and it's time for a track review. And I'm going to be diving into this latest song over here from Miss Lana Del Rey. She is teaming up with Jack Antonoff of Fun and Bleachers fame on this new cut over here, which could make for an interesting change of pace, as Jack does tend to favor very bright and peppy instrumentation, though I don't anticipate we're going to see a total 180 here from Lana, as she has a pretty established sound that she's most likely not to veer from at this point, as her fans just can't seem to get enough of it. Her last full-length album was with Sean Lennon, though. So, again, could be a bit of an instrumental sea change here. She has a new album coming in 2019. I will most definitely be looking out for that. And this new song, if I haven't said already, is Mariner's Apartment Complex. Let's give it a shot. See what's up. See what Lana has to offer on this brand new single. Ba-bam. Okay. Enjoyed that quite a bit. I'm actually a little shocked by it. While Lana has not changed up her sound all that greatly on this new track over here, I will say the addition of Jack into the mix has made for a big change. Maybe it'll be a subtle change that fans won't really notice or care about, but I think it has made for a pretty significant change that has at least hit me pretty hard. Because typically up until this point, Lana's songs are very soaked in reverb, like caked on. If I can make an analogy here, I would liken it to just like wearing too much foundation or something, you know, because it's to the point where you're soaking your stuff in so much reverb where you're washing your music out, you're hiding more than you are enhancing or making what exactly you're trying to get people to pay attention to appealing. By contrast, the strings, the guitars, the vocals, the piano, especially during the whole first leg of this track, are very naked, very straightforward, very clean, and very intimate too, especially Lana's voice. Lana's voice is very intimate, very up close, very in your face. It's almost to the point where she's like singing in your ear. And it's a nice change of pace because her voice and the instrumentation sound nice. They sound lush. They sound beautiful. They sound full, especially when they are swelling toward the back end as Jack kind of drives it into a very grand instrumental swell, which goes over really well. Lana's voice, while she's still not the best vocalist on the block, she has quite a bit of, dynamics to it. She does swell with the instrumentation nicely as it builds up. She delivers some very moody and low-key croons throughout the verses, switching subtly here and there to some spoken word bits that are a bit whispery and sensual and sexy. It's very sexy and sad, like Lana's songs tend to be. But I just think the sound of this track is better, and the ballad is really nice too. It's on a pretty tried and true
chord progression. Nothing all that brand new compositionally about this track, but I do think it's beautiful, it's dramatic, and it's performed and put together pretty well. Again, lush instrumentation. The lyrics, I don't mind all that much either. It's kind of like a mix of heartbreak and lovesick, and also kind of being this person who, this individual who you imagine yourself being in love with is obsessed with you, or kind of a big change and something in this person's life that everything revolves around in a way. There are themes of forgiveness and breaking up, but staying together as well. I couldn't exactly get a super clear sense of what exactly the story or the narrative of this song is, but again, didn't really mind the lyrics all that much. Certainly not the cliched and I guess tough to swallow themes of being like a weak waifish woman falling into the arms of a bad boy. That I typically get out of Lana's older songs, though, you know, respect to her for, I guess, kind of drifting away from that a little bit on her past couple of albums anyway. So having said all that, I don't really know if there's much about this track that I dislike. I guess it doesn't have the catchiest melody in the world, as, again, the verses on the track are melodically a little humdrum, and Lana does tend to sink into those whispery vocals a little bit too much if she wanted to make a huge melodic impact on the audience. But I still think it's a well put together song. I still like the vocals quite a bit. I think the instrumentation is grand and beautiful and gorgeous. And this is the most I have enjoyed a Lana song in a while. I mean, there have been a few songs here and there off her past couple of records that I've loved or thought were great, but I think this one might even blow some of those out of the water. So, yeah, I'm kind of digging this a lot. This is really good. Eminem, legendary rapper, just dropped a pretty controversial new album titled Kamikaze, on which he dissed a lot of different rappers. He has also followed that album up with a pretty lengthy series of interview bits featuring him and Sway. I will be having a video drop very soon where I'm reacting to some of the points he makes in that interview series. He also talks about MGK in that interview. When I was originally responding to the interview series, I thought that Eminem's response to MGK there was sufficient, because I just kind of see MGK as dog do under his shoe and not really all that talented or important or relevant, not worth Eminem's time. I would have just said it's probably not worth it to drop a response track to MGK's diss song against Eminem. It would basically be a waste of time. But hey, Eminem is here to entertain, apparently, and he just came through with the diss track just now. So I'm going to give it a shot. See what's up. See how hard he goes at MGK, one of the weakest rappers in the game. Let's see what's up. Eminem Killshot. Bam. Holy shit. What? Oh my God. Oh my God. Wow. That was brutal. That was not nice. That was not nice. Man, you know, this kind of reminds me of the Chloroseptic remix, in that M comes out with a record where he's just getting beat on, and then he just follows up with another song where it's like, holy shit, you know, where the fuck was this guy? But this track, man, the beat was pretty good. And not that there weren't good beats on Kamikaze, there were some, but the beat was great. The flows were always changing, but nothing too overly technical and masturbatory and weird sounding and just wanky, like just smart, catchy, straightforward flows with some interesting rhythmic breakups here and there to sort of make certain rhymes link or enunciate certain words, certain ways to make the double entendre or basically the scheme of the the couple of bars that he's rapping connect in a very smart way. This is Eminem really performance-wise at his best in a while, where he's kind of striking a great balance of making a hip-hop song that is a cut above technically a lot of what you're going to hear out there, but simultaneously it's accessible, it's listenable. Like, there's a good groove to a lot of what he's rapping on this thing. But man, just to get into the bars on this thing, he was just going at fucking MGK. Like, listen, I thought the MGK diss was all right, but kind of boring, kind of bland. And that diss is just shameful in comparison to what Eminem has just dropped here. Because the amount of really deeply insulting lines here on this track are just innumerable in comparison to, like, the couple of spare shots that were okay that MGK threw on his track, along with the Eminem, you're old, you're bitter, you're over the hill, which everybody else is saying anyway. You know, what are you going to bring to the table that other people aren't already saying? So, man, the Rihanna line with him talking about putting hickeys on her neck, I thought was really funny, given what MGK said in his last track. The autograph for his daughter line. I'm just sort of rolling through some of the lyrics now, just kind of remind myself so I don't miss anything that really stuck out to me. There was also that line about how he named himself after a gun, but he has a man bun. And man, when he went by saying that at 45, I'm outselling you, I'm still outselling you, which is true, because Eminem still at this low point in his career is doing numbers that for a lot of new artists now is going to be the height of their career, or they wish could be the height of their career. So a lot of these artists, like, taking shots at Eminem for not being as good as he used to, he's still getting a lot of attention, and he still has a lot of fans who care about his music and celebrate it quite a bit. I should know, a lot of them were attacking me for a full week after dropping my Kamikaze review, but whatever. But still, though, I thought the bars that he was throwing out there about making MGK into a mountain from a molehill was really smart, because Eminem really is doing him a favor just by responding, because for the next 5 years, this is probably going to be the most attention MGK gets. Really, it truly is, because MGK is probably not going to have another big hit song unless he drops a response diss to Eminem, which wouldn't necessarily be a hit. It'll be a song that probably gets some traction here and there, but it's not going to be a chart climber. Loved the bar on here when he was talking about how bitter he is that G-Eazy is sleeping with his ex, Halsey. The dictionary line was funny given what MGK said in his diss track. You know, it's really funny. Eminem really addressed a lot of what came up in that song, like the few okay shots at him, and then threw so much more at him on top of it. Thought it was funny with his math being wrong about the number of albums, according to him, it's been since he made a good one. I loved the line where he said, I'd rather be 80-year-old me than 20-year-old you, talking about how back when he was his age, he already had a bunch of records that had been blown huge. So if MGK is really as good as Eminem or gonna be good as Eminem, you're already way behind the curve, because already at this point, Eminem was killing it. Yeah, I didn't really think there was a part of this diss track that was boring. It was thoroughly entertaining, really tore the dude apart and exposed him for being as boring and mediocre as he is. Because MGK, he might respond to this. He might put out a response. Honestly, he probably will, because what does MGK have going for him right now? He's probably not very busy. He's certainly not recording any hits as of right now. MGK in the studio right now recording a number one song, it's not happening. So now that it's out, he's most likely going to put out a response track because, again, nothing better to do, but it will not have anywhere near as many cold-blooded and boldly insulting lines as this track has going for it. And the attitude of this song for Eminem is so refreshing. You know, to me, this is so much better than what he was doing on a lot of Kamikaze, which I've said before and I'll say it again, seemed like he was acting mostly out of bitterness. This track to me felt like a solid diss song where he's really kind of letting the bullshit that MGK threw at him just roll off his back. And that's how it should be, because MGK's opinion of Eminem does not matter at all. Even if he's saying something that is correct about Eminem, does not matter, does not factor, because he's an irrelevant artist with not much in the way of talent or important, significant pieces of work. So I'm going to leave it at that. Loved the track. Thought it was really good.
And there we have another edition of the Needle Drop Podcast. Thank all of you for listening. Make sure to hit us up on youtube.com/theneedledrop or youtube.com/Fantano for more of our segments, more of our videos, more of our reviews, more of our think pieces over on twitter.com/theneedledrop. And you can find us on theneedledrop.com as well to catch all of our articles and features and whatnot. Also want to give a shout out to Jonah for cutting this podcast together, producing the podcast as well as he does. And if I haven't already, I want to thank all of you for listening. All right. We'll see you in the next episode. We'll see you in the next episode. We'll see you. You'll hear me. I won't see you. Okay? All right. I love you. Have a good one.
Forever.